She looked down at what she had drawn. Two figures stood on the landing above, wearing the two straight robes, like cloth made from metal. They leaned down, watching her go. She looked up again. The landing was empty. "What's happening to me?" she thought with increasing horror. When the lift hit the ground, she scrambled away, her skirt fluttering. She all but ran to the exit of the veil, hesitating beside the doorway, ignoring the master servants and ardents who gave her confused looks. Where to go? Sweat trickled down the sides of her face. Where to run when you were going mad? She cut into the main cavern's crowd. It was late afternoon and the dinner rush had begun, servants pushing dining carts, light eyes strolling to their rooms, scholars walking with hands behind their backs. Shallan dashed through their midst, her hair coming free of its bun, the hair spike dropping to the rock behind her with a high-pitched clink. Her loose red hair streamed behind. She reached the hallway leading to their rooms, panting, hair askew, and glanced over her shoulder. Amid the flow of traffic, she'd left a trail of people looking after her in confusion. Almost against her will, she blinked and took a memory. She raised her pad again, gripping her charcoal pencil in slick fingers, quickly sketching the crowded cavern scene, just faint impressions. Men of lines, women of curves, walls of sloping rock, carpeted floor, bursts of light in sphere lanterns on the walls, and five symbol-headed figures in black, too stiff robes and cloaks. Each had a different symbol, twisted and unfamiliar to her, hanging above a necklace torso. The figures wove through the crowd unseen, like predators, focused on Shallan. I'm just imagining it, she tried to tell herself. I'm overtaxed, too many things weighing on me. Did they represent her guilt? The stress of betraying Jasnah and lying to Kabsel? The things she had done before leaving Yakaved? She tried to stand there waiting, but her fingers refused to remain still. She blinked, then started drawing again on a new sheet. She finished with a shaking hand. The figures were almost to her, angular knot heads hanging horrifically where faces should have been. Logic warned that she was overreacting, but no matter what she told herself, she couldn't believe it. These were real, and they were coming for her. She dashed away, surprising several servants who had been approaching her to offer assistance. She ran, slippered feet sliding on the hallway carpets, eventually reaching the door to Jasnah's rooms. Sketch pad under her arm, she unlocked it with quivering fingers, then pushed through and slammed it behind her. She locked it again and ran for her chamber. She slammed that door closed too, then turned, backing away. The only light in the room came from the three diamond marks in the large crystal goblet on her nightstand. She got on the bed, then scrambled back as far from the door as she could until she was against the wall, breathing through her nose with frantic breaths. She still had her sketch pad under her arm, though she'd lost the charcoal. There was more in her nightstand. Don't do it, she thought. Just sit and calm yourself. She felt a growing chill, a rising terror. She had to know. She scrambled to pull out the charcoal, then blinked and began to sketch her room. Ceiling first. Four straight lines. Down the walls. Lines at the corners. Her fingers kept moving, drawing, depicting the pad itself, held before her, safe hand shrouded and bracing the pad from behind. And then on. To the beings standing around her, twisted symbols unconnected to their uneven shoulders. Those knot heads had unreal angles, surfaces that melded in weird, impossible ways. The creature at the front was reaching two smooth fingers toward Shallan, just inches from the right side of the sketch pad. Oh, Stormfather, Shallan thought, charcoal pencil falling still. The room was empty, yet depicted right in front of her was an image of it crowded full of sleek figures. They were close enough that she should be able to feel them breathing if they breathed. Was there a chill in the room? Hesitantly, terrified but unable to stop herself, Shallan dropped her pencil and raised her free hand to the right, and felt something. She screamed then, jumping to her feet on her bed, dropping the pad backing against the wall. Before she could consciously think of what she was doing, she was struggling with her sleeve, trying to get the soul caster out. It was the only thing she had resembling a weapon. No, that was stupid. She didn't know how to use it. She was helpless. Except... Storms, she thought, frantic. I can't use that. I promised myself. She began the process anyway. 10 heartbeats, to bring forth the fruit of her sin, the proceeds of her most horrific act. She was interrupted midway through by a voice, uncanny yet distinct. What are you? She clutched her hand to her chest, losing her balance on the soft bed, falling to her knees on the rumpled blanket. She put one hand to the side, steadying herself on the nightstand, fingers brushing the large glass goblet that sat there. What am I? She whispered. I'm terrified. This is true. The bedroom transformed around her. The bed, the nightstand, her sketch pad, the walls, the ceiling, everything seemed to pop, forming into tiny dark glass spheres. She found herself in a place with a black sky and a strange small white sun that hung on the horizon, too far away. Shallan screamed as she found herself in midair, falling backward in a shower of beads. Flames hovered nearby, dozens of them, perhaps hundreds, like the tips of candles floating in the air and moving in the wind. She hit something, an endless dark sea, except it wasn't wet. It was made of the small beads, an entire ocean of tiny glass spheres. They surged around her, moving in an undulating swell. She gasped, flailing, trying to stay afloat. You want me to change? A warm voice said in her mind, distinct and different from the cold whisper she had heard earlier. It was deep and hollow and conveyed a sense of great age. It seemed to come from her hand, and she realized she was grasping something there, one of the beads. The movement of the ocean of glass threatened to tow her down. She kicked frantically, somehow managing to stay afloat. I've been as I am for a great long time, the warm voice said. I sleep so much. I will change. Give me what you have.
I don't know what you mean. Please help me.
I will change. She felt suddenly cold, as if the warmth were being drawn from her. She screamed as the bead in her fingers flared to sudden warmth. She dropped it just as a shift in the ocean swell towed her under, beads rolling over one another with a soft clatter. She fell back and hit her bed, back in her room. Beside her, the goblet on her nightstand melted, the glass becoming red liquid, dropping the 3 spheres inside to the nightstand's flooded top. The red liquid poured over the sides of the nightstand, splashing to the floor. Shallan pulled back, horrified. The goblet had been changed into blood. Her shocked motion thumped the nightstand, shaking it. An empty glass water pitcher had been sitting beside the goblet. Her motion knocked it over, toppling it to the ground. It shattered on the stone floor, splashing the blood. That was a soul casting, she thought. She'd changed the goblet into blood, which was one of the 10 essences. She raised her hand to her head, staring at the red liquid expanding in a pool on her floor. There seemed to be quite a lot of it. She was so bewildered. The voice, the creatures, the sea of glass beads and the dark, cold sky. It had all come upon her so quickly. I soul cast, she realized again. I did it. Did it have something to do with the creatures? But she'd begun seeing them in her drawings before she'd ever stolen the soul caster. How? What? She looked down at her safe hand and the soul caster hidden in the pouch inside her sleeve. I didn't put it on, she thought. Yet I used it anyway. Shallan? It was Yasna's voice, just outside Shallan's room. The princess must have followed her. Shallan felt a spike of terror as she saw a line of blood leaking toward the doorway. It was almost there and would pass underneath in a heartbeat. Why did it have to be blood? Nauseated, she leaped to her feet, slippers soaking up the red liquid. Shallan, Yasna said, voice closer. What was that sound? Shallan looked frantically at the blood, then at the sketch pad filled with pictures of the strange creatures. What if they did have something to do with the soul casting? Yasna would recognize them. There was a shadow under the door. She panicked, tucking the sketch pad away in her trunk. But the blood, it would condemn her. There was enough that only a life-threatening wound could have created it. Yasna would see. She'd know. Blood where there should be none? One of the 10 essences? Yasna was going to know what Shallan had done. A thought struck Shallan. It wasn't a brilliant thought, but it was a way out, and it was the only thing that occurred to her. She went to her knees and grabbed a shard of the broken glass pitcher in her safe hand, through the fabric of her sleeve. She took a breath and pulled up her right sleeve, then used the glass to cut a shallow gash in her skin. In the panic of the moment, it barely even hurt. Blood welled out. As the doorknob turned and the door opened, Shallan dropped the glass shard and lay on her side. She closed her eyes, feigning unconsciousness. The door swung open. Yasna gasped, immediately calling for help. She rushed to Shallan's side, grabbing her arm and putting pressure on the wound. Shallan mumbled as if she were barely conscious, gripping her safe pouch and the soul caster inside with her safe hand. They wouldn't open it, would they? She pulled her arm closer to her chest, cowering silently as more footsteps and calls sounded, servants and parshmen running into the room, Yasna shouting for more help. This, Shallan thought, will not end well.
XLVI. Child of Tanavast. Though I was due for dinner in the Vaden City that night, I insisted upon visiting Kolinar to speak with Tivbet. The tariffs through Urethiru were growing quite unreasonable. By then, the so-called Radiance had already begun to show their true nature. Following the firing of the original Palaneum, only one page of Terxim's autobiography remained, and this is the only line of any use to me. Kaladin dreamed he was the storm. He raged forward, the storm wall behind him his trailing cape, soaring above a heaving black expanse. The ocean. His passing churned up a tempest, slamming waves into one another, lifting white caps to be caught in his wind. He approached a dark continent and soared upward, higher, higher. He left the sea behind. The vastness of the continent spread out before him, seemingly endless, an ocean of rock. So large, he thought, awed. He hadn't understood. How could he have? He roared past the shattered plains. They looked as if something very large had hit them at the center, sending rippling breaks outward. They, too, were larger than he'd expected. No wonder nobody had been able to find their way through the chasms. There was a large plateau at the center, but with the darkness and the distance, he could not see much. There were lights, though. Someone lived there. He did see that the eastern side of the plains was very different from the western side, marked by tall, spindly pillars, plateaus that had nearly been worn away. Despite that, he could see a symmetry to the shattered plains. From high above, the plains resembled a work of art. In a moment, he was past them, continuing north and west to soar across the Sea of Spears, a shallow inland sea where broken fingers of rock jutted above the water. He passed over Alethkar, catching a glimpse of the great city of Kolinar, built amid formations of rock like fins rising from the stone. Then he turned southward, away from anything he knew. He crested majestic mountains, densely populated at their tips, with villages clustered near vents that emitted steam or lava. The Horn-Eater Peaks? He left them with rain and winds, rumbling down into foreign lands. He passed cities and open plains, villages and twisting waterways. Kaladin passed tents pulled flat against the leeward side of rock formations, stakes driven into the rock to hold them taut, men hidden inside. He passed hillsides where soldiers huddled in clefts. He passed large wooden wagons, built to house light eyes while at war. How many wars was the world fighting? Was there nowhere that was at peace? He took a path to the southwest, blowing toward a city built in long troughs in the ground that looked like giant claw marks ripped across the landscape. He was over it in a flash, passing a hinterland where the stone itself was ribbed and rippled, like frozen waves of water. The people in this kingdom were dark-skinned, like Sigzil. The land went on and on. Hundreds of cities, thousands of villages. People with faintly blue veins beneath their skin, a place where the pressure of the approaching high storm blew water out of spouts in the ground. A city where people lived in gigantic hollowed-out stalactites, hanging beneath a titanic sheltered ridge. Westward he blew. The land was so vast, so enormous, so many different people. It dazzled his mind. War seemed far less prevalent in the west than it was in the east, and that comforted him, but still he was troubled. Peace seemed a scarce commodity in the world. Something drew his attention, strange flashes of light. He blew toward them at the forefront of the storm. What were those lights? They came in bursts, forming the strangest patterns. Almost like physical things that he could reach out and touch. Spherical bubbles of light that vibrated with spikes and troughs. Kaladin crossed a strange city laid out in a triangular pattern, with tall peaks rising like sentries at the corners and center. The flashes of light were coming from a building on the central peak. Kaladin knew he would pass quickly, for as the storm he could not retreat. Ever westward he blew. He threw open the door with his wind, entering a long hallway with bright red tile walls, mosaic murals that he passed too quickly to make out. He rustled the skirts of tall, golden-haired serving women, who carried trays of food or steaming towels. They called in a strange language, perhaps wondering who had left a window unbarred in a high storm. The flashes of light came from directly ahead. So transfixing. Brushing past a pretty gold and red-haired woman who huddled frightened in a corner, Kaladin burst through a door. He had one brief glimpse of what lay beyond. A man stood over two corpses. His pale head shaved, his clothing white, the murderer held a long, thin sword in one hand. He looked up from his victims and almost seemed to see Kaladin. He had large shin eyes. It was too late to see anything more. Kaladin blew out the window, throwing shutters wide and streaking into the night. More cities, mountains, and forests passed in a blur. At his advent, plants curled up their leaves, rock buds closed their shells, and shrubs withdrew their branches. Before long, he neared the western ocean.
Child of Tanavast, child of honor, child of one long since departed.
The sudden voice shook Kaladin. He floundered in the air.
The oath pact was shattered.
The booming sound made the storm wall itself vibrate. Kaladin hit the ground, separating from the storm. He skidded to a stop, feet throwing up sprays of water. Storm winds crashed into him, but he was enough a part of them that they neither tossed nor shook him.
Men ride the storms no longer.
The voice was thunder, crashing in the air.
The oath pact is broken, child of honor.
I don't understand, Kaladin screamed into the tempest.
A face formed before him, the face he had seen before. The aged face as wide as the sky, its eyes full of stars.
Odium comes. Most dangerous of all the 16. You will now go.
Something blew against him.
Wait, Kaladin said. Why is there so much war? Must we always fight?
He wasn't sure why he asked. The questions simply came out. The storm rumbled like a thoughtful, aged father. The face vanished, shattering into droplets of water. More softly, the voice answered,
"Odium reigns."
Kaladin gasped as he awoke. He was surrounded by dark figures holding him down against the hard stone floor. He yelled, old reflexes taking over. Instinctively, he snapped his hands outward to the sides, each grabbing an ankle and jerking to pull two assailants off balance. They cursed, crashing to the ground. Kaladin used the moment to twist while bringing an arm up in a sweep. He knocked free the hands pushing him down, rocked and threw himself forward, lurching into the man directly in front of him. Kaladin rolled over him, tucking and coming up on his feet, free of his captives. He spun, flinging sweat from his brow. Where was his spear? He clutched for the knife at his belt. No knife, no spear.
"Storm you, Kaladin?"
That was Teft. Kaladin raised a hand to his breast, breathing deliberately, dispelling the strange dream. Bridge Four. He was with Bridge Four. The king's storm wardens had predicted a high storm in the early morning hours.
"It's all right,"
he said to the cursing, twisting clump of bridgemen who had been holding him down.
"What were you doing?"
"You tried to go out in the storm,"
Moash said accusingly, extricating himself. The only light was a single diamond sphere one of the men had set in the corner.
"Oh,"
Rock added, standing up and brushing himself off.
"Had the door open to the rain, staring out as if you'd been hit on the head with stone. We had to pull you back. It's not good for you to spend another 2 weeks sick in bed, eh?"
Kaladin calmed himself. The riddens, the quiet rainfall at the trailing end of a high storm, continued outside, drops sprinkling the roof.
"You wouldn't wake up," Sigzel said.
Kaladin glanced at the Azish man, sitting with his back to the stone wall. He hadn't tried to hold Kaladin down.
"You were having some kind of fever dream."
"I feel just fine," Kaladin said.
That wasn't quite true. His head ached and he was exhausted. He took a deep breath and threw back his shoulders, trying to force the fatigue away. The sphere in the corner flickered. Then its light faded away, leaving them in darkness.
"Storm it," Moash muttered. "That eel Gaz. He's been giving us dun spheres again."
Kaladin crossed the pitch-black barrack, stepping carefully. His headache faded away as he felt for the door. He pushed it open, letting in the faint light of an overcast morning. The winds were weak, but the rain still fell. He stepped out and was shortly soaked through. The other bridgemen followed him out, and Rock tossed Kaladin a small chunk of soap. Like most of the others, Kaladin wore only his loincloth, and he lathered himself up in the cold downpour. The soap smelled of oil and was gritty with the sand suspended in it. No sweet, soft soaps for bridgemen. Kaladin tossed the bit of soap to Bissig, a thin bridgeman with an angular face. He took it gratefully, Bissig didn't say much, and began to lather up as Kaladin let the rain wash the soap from his body and hair. To the side, Rock was using a bowl of water to shave and trim his horn-eater beard, long on the sides and covering the cheeks, but clean below the lips and chin. It was an odd counterpoint to his head, which he shaved up the center from directly above the eyebrows back. He trimmed the rest of his hair short. Rock's hand was smooth and careful, and he didn't so much as nick himself. Once finished, he stood up and waved to the men waiting behind him. One by one, he shaved any who wanted it. He occasionally paused to sharpen the razor, using his whetstone and leather strop. Kaladin raised his fingers to his own beard. He hadn't been clean-shaven since he'd been in Amaram's army so long ago. He walked forward to join those waiting in line. When Kaladin's time came, the large horn-eater laughed.
"Sit, my friend. Sit. It's good you have come. Your face is more like scragglebark branches than a proper beard."
"Shave it clean," Kaladin said,
sitting down on the stump. And I'd rather not have a strange pattern like yours.
Ah, Rock said, sharpening his razor. You are a lowlander, my good friend. It's not right for you to wear a humaka aban. I would have to thump you soundly if you tried this thing.
I thought you said fighting was beneath you.
He's allowed several important exceptions, Rock said. Now stop with your talking, unless you wish to be losing a lip.
Rock began by trimming the beard down, then lathered and shaved, starting at the left cheek. Kaladin had never let another shave him before. When he'd first gone to war, he'd been young enough that he'd barely needed to shave at all. He'd grown into doing it himself as he got older. Rock's touch was deft, and Kaladin didn't feel any nicks or cuts. In a few minutes, Rock stood back. Kaladin raised his fingers to his chin, touching smooth, sensitive skin. His face felt cold, strange to the touch. It took him back, transformed him, just a little, into the man he had been. Strange how much difference a shave could make. I should have done this weeks ago. The riddens had turned to drizzle, heralding the storm's last whispers. Kaladin stood up, letting the water wash bits of shorn hair from his chest. Baby-faced Dunny, the last of those waiting, sat down for his turn at being shaven. He hardly needed it at all. The shave suits you, a voice said. Kaladin turned to see Sigzil leaning against the wall of the barrack just under the roof's overhang. Your face has strong lines, square and firm with a proud chin. We would call it a leader's face among my people. I'm no light eyes, Kaladin said, spitting to the side. You hate them so much. I hate their lies, Kaladin said. I hate it that I used to believe they were honorable. And would you cast them down? Sigzil asked, sounding curious. Rule in their place? No. This seemed to surprise Sigzil. To the side, Syl finally appeared, having finished frolicking in the winds of the high storm. He always worried, just a little, that she'd ride away with them and leave him. Have you no thirst to punish those who have treated you so? Sigzil asked. Oh, I'm happy to punish them, Kaladin said. But I have no desire to take their place, nor do I wish to join them. I'd join them in a heartbeat, Moash said, walking up behind. He folded his arms across his lean, well-muscled chest. If I were in charge, things would change. The Light Eyes would work in the mines and the fields. They would run bridges and die by Parshendi arrows. Won't happen, Kaladin said. But I won't blame you for trying. Sigzil nodded thoughtfully. Have either of you ever heard of the land of Babatharnam? No, Kaladin said, glancing toward the camp. The soldiers were moving about now. More than a few were washing, too. That's a funny name for a country, though. Sigzil sniffed. Personally, I always thought Alethkar sounded like a ridiculous name. I guess it depends on where you were raised.
So I bring up Moash said.
Babatharnam, Sigzil said. I visited there once with my master. They have very peculiar trees. The entire plant, trunk and all, lies down when a high storm approaches, as if built on hinges. I was thrown in prison 3 times during our visit there. The Babith are quite particular about how you speak. My master was quite displeased at the amount he had to pay to free me. Of course, I think they were using any excuse to imprison a foreigner, as they knew my master had deep pockets. He smiled wistfully. One of those imprisonments was my fault. The women there, you see, have these patterns of veins that sit shallowly beneath their skin. Some visitors find it unnerving, but I found the patterns beautiful, almost irresistible. Kaladin frowned. Hadn't he seen something like that in his dream? I bring up Babeth because they have a curious system of rule there, Sigzil continued. You see, the elderly are given office. The older you are, the more authority you have. Everyone gets a chance to rule if they live long enough. The king is called the most ancient.
Sounds fair, Moash said, walking over to join Sigzil beneath the overhang. Better than deciding who rules based on eye color.
Ah, yes, Sigzil said. The Babeth are very fair. Currently, the Monovaca dynasty reigns.
How can you have a dynasty if you choose your leaders based on their age? Kaladin asked.
It's actually quite easy, Sigzil said. You just execute anyone who gets old enough to challenge you.
Kaladin felt a chill. They do that?
Yes, unfortunately, Sigzil said. There is a great deal of unrest in Babatharnum. It was dangerous to visit when we did. The Monovacas make very certain that their family members live the longest. For 50 years, no one outside their family has become most ancient. All others have fallen through assassination, exile, or death on the battlefield.
That's horrible, Kaladin said.
I doubt many would disagree. But I mention these horrors for a purpose. You see, it has been my experience that no matter where you go, you will find some who abuse their power.
He shrugged.
Eye color is not so odd a method compared to many others I have seen. If you were to overthrow the Light Eyes and place yourselves in power, Moash, I doubt that the world would be a very different place. The abuses would still happen, simply to other people.
Kaladin nodded slowly, but Moash shook his head. No, I'd change the world, Sigzil, and I mean to.
And how are you going to do that? Kaladin asked, amused.
I came to this war to get myself a shard blade, Moash said. And I still mean to do it, somehow.
He blushed, then turned away.
You joined up assuming they'd make you a spearman, didn't you? Kaladin asked.
Moash hesitated, then nodded.
Some of those who joined with me did become soldiers, but most of us got sent to the bridge crews.
He glanced at Kaladin, expression growing dark.
This plan of yours had better work, Lordling. Last time I ran away, I got a beating. I was told if I tried again, I'd get a slave's mark instead.
I never promised it would work, Moash. If you've got a better idea, go ahead and share it.
Moash hesitated. Well, if you really do teach us the spear like you promised, then I guess I don't care.
Kaladin glanced about, warily checking to see if Gaz or any bridgemen from other crews were nearby.
Keep quiet, Kaladin muttered to Moash. Don't speak of that outside the chasms.
The rain had almost stopped. Soon the clouds would break. Moash glared at him, but remained silent.
You don't really think they'd let you have a shard blade, do you? Sigzil said. Any man can win a shard blade, Moash said. Slave or free. Light eyes or dark. It's the law.
Assuming they follow the law, Kaladin said with a sigh.
I'll do it somehow, Moash repeated.
He glanced to the side where Rock was closing up his razor and wiping the rainwater from his bald head. The Horn Eater approached them.
I have heard of this place you spoke of, Sigzil, Rock said. Babatharnum. My cousin visited there one time. They have very tasty snails.
That is a long distance to travel for a Horn Eater, Sigzil noted.
Nearly same distance as for an Azish, Rock said. Actually much more, since you have such little legs.
Sigzil scowled.
I have seen your kind before, Rock said, folding his arms.
What? Sigzil asked. Azish? We are not so rare.
No, not your race, Rock said. Your type? What is it they are called? Visiting places around the land, telling others of what they have seen? A world singer. Yes, is the right name? No?
Sigsel froze, then he suddenly stood up straight and stalked away from the barrack without looking back.
Now why is he acting like this thing? Rock asked. I am not ashamed of being cook. Why is he ashamed of being world singer?
World singer? Kaladin asked. Rock shrugged.
I do not know much. A strange people. Say they must travel to each kingdom and tell the people there of other kingdoms. Is a kind of storyteller, though they are thinking of themselves as much more.
He's probably some kind of bright lord in his country, Moash said. The way he talks. Wonder how he ended up with us Kremlings.
Hey, Dunny said, joining them. What'd you do to Sigsel? He promised to tell me about my homeland.
Homeland? Moash said to the younger man. You're from Alethkar.
Sigsel said these violet eyes of mine aren't native to Alethkar. He thinks I must have Vaden blood in me.
Your eyes aren't violet, Moash said.
Sure they are, Dunny said. You can see it in bright sunlight. They're just really dark.
Ha!
Rock said.
If you are from Vadenar, we are cousins. The peaks are near Vadenar. Sometimes the people there have good red hair like us.
Be glad that someone didn't mistake your eyes for red, Dunny, Kaladin said. Moash, Rock, go gather your sub-squads and pass the word to Teft and Scar. I want the men oiling their vests and sandals against the humidity.
The men sighed, but did as ordered. The army provided the oil. While the bridgemen were expendable, good hogshide and metal for buckles were not cheap. As the men gathered to work, the sun broke through the clouds. The warmth of the light felt good on Kaladin's rain-wet skin. There was something refreshing about the chill of a high storm followed by the sun. Tiny rockbud polyps on the side of the building opened, drinking in the wet air. Those would have to be scraped free. Rockbuds would eat away the stone of the walls, creating pockmarks and cracks. The buds were a deep crimson. It was Chachal, third day of the week. The slave markets would show new wares. That would mean new bridgemen. Kaladin's crew was in serious danger. Yake had caught an arrow in the arm during their last run, and Delp had caught one in the neck. There'd been nothing Kaladin could do for him, and with Yake wounded, Kaladin's team was down to 28 bridge-capable members. Sure enough, about an hour into their morning activities, caring for equipment, oiling the bridge, Lopin and Dabid running to fetch their morning gruel pot and bring it back to the lumberyard, Kaladin caught sight of soldiers leading a line of dirty, shuffling men toward the lumberyard. Kaladin gestured to Teft, and the two of them marched up to meet Gaz.
Before you yell at me, Gaz said as Kaladin arrived, understand that I can't change anything here.
The slaves were bunched up, watched over by a pair of soldiers in wrinkled green coats.
You're bridge sergeant, Kaladin said.
Teft stepped up beside him. He hadn't gotten a shave, though he'd begun keeping his short gray beard neatly trimmed.
Yeah, Gaz said. But I don't make assignments anymore. Brightness Hashal wants to do it herself. In the name of her husband, of course.
Kaladin gritted his teeth. She'd starve Bridge Four of members. So we get nothing.
I didn't say that, Gaz said, then spat black spittle to the side. She gave you one.
That's something at least, Kaladin thought. There were a good 100 men in the new group.
Which one? He'd better be tall enough to carry a bridge. Oh, he's tall enough, Gaz said, gesturing a few slaves out of the way. Good worker, too.
The men shuffled aside, revealing one man standing at the back. He was a little shorter than average, but he was still tall enough to carry a bridge. But he had blackened red marbled skin.
A parchment? Kaladin asked.
To his side, Teft cursed under his breath.
Why not? Gaz said. They're perfect slaves. Never talk back.
But we're at war with them, Teft said.
We're at war with a tribe of oddities, Gaz said. Those out on the Shattered Plains are right different from the fellows who work for us.
That much, at least, was true. There were a lot of Parshmen in the war camp, and, despite their skin markings, there was little similarity between them and the Parshendi warriors. None had the strange growths of armor-like carapace on their skin, for instance. Kaladin eyed the sturdy, bald man. The Parshman stared at the ground. He wore only a loincloth, and he had a thickness about him. His fingers were thicker than those of human men, his arms stouter, his thighs wider.
He's domesticated, Gaz said. You don't need to worry.
I thought Parshmen were too valuable to use in bridge runs, Kaladin said.
This is just an experiment, Gaz said. Brightness Hashal wants to know her options. Finding enough bridgemen has been difficult lately, and Parshmen could help fill in holes.
This is foolish, Gaz, Teft said. I don't care if he's domesticated or not. Asking him to carry a bridge against others of his kind is pure idiocy. What if he betrays us?
Gaz shrugged.
We'll see if that happens.
But...
Leave it, Teft, Kaladin said.
You, Parshmen, come with me.
He turned to walk back down the hill. The Parshmen dutifully followed. Teft cursed and did so as well.
What trick are they trying on us, do you think?
Teft asked.
I suspect it's just what he said. A test to see if a Parshman can be trusted to run bridges. Perhaps he'll do as he's told. Or perhaps he'll refuse to run, or will try to kill us. She wins regardless.
Kalek's breath, Teft cursed. Darker than a horn eater's stomach, our situation is. She'll see us dead, Kaladin.
I know.
He glanced over his shoulder at the Parshman. He was a little taller than most, his face a little wider, but they all looked about the same to Kaladin. The other members of Bridge Four had lined up by the time Kaladin returned. They watched the approaching Parshman with surprise and disbelief. Kaladin stopped before them, Teft at his side, the Parshman behind. It made him itch to have one of them behind him. He casually stepped to the side. The Parshman just stood there, eyes downward, shoulders slumped. Kaladin glanced at the others. They had guessed, and they were growing hostile.
Stormfather, Kaladin thought. There is something lower in this world than a bridgeman. A Parshman bridgeman.
Parshman might cost more than most slaves, but so did a chal. In fact, the comparison was a good one, because Parshmen were worked like animals. Seeing the reaction of the others made Kaladin pity the creature, and that made him mad at himself. Did he always have to react this way? This Parshman was dangerous, a distraction for the other men, a factor they couldn't depend on, a liability. Turn a liability into an advantage whenever you can. Those words had been spoken by a man who cared only for his own skin.
Storm it, Kaladin thought. I'm a fool. A downright sodden idiot. This isn't the same. Not at all.
Parshman, he asked. Do you have a name? The man shook his head. Parshman rarely spoke. They could, but you had to prod them into it.
Well, we'll have to call you something, Kaladin said.
How about Shen?
The man shrugged.
All right, then, Kaladin said to the others. This is Shen. He's one of us now.
A Parshman, Lopan asked, lounging beside the barrack. I don't like the look of him, Goncho. Look how he stares at me.
He'll kill us while we sleep, Moash added.
No, this is good, Scar said. We can just have him run at the front. He'll take an arrow for one of us.
Scylla alighted on Kaladin's shoulder, looking down at the parchment. Her eyes were sorrowful. If you were to overthrow the Light Eyes and place yourselves in power, abuses would still happen. They'd just happen to other people. But this was a parchment. Gotta do what you can to stay alive.
No, Kaladin said. Shen is one of us now. I don't care what he was before. I don't care what any of you were. We're Bridge Four. So is he.
But, Scar began.
No, Kaladin said. We're not going to treat him like the Light Eyes treat us, Scar. That's all there is to it. Rock, find him a vest and sandals.
The bridgemen split up, all save Teft.
What about our plans? Teft asked quietly.
We proceed, Kaladin said.
Teft looked uncomfortable about that.
What's he going to do, Teft? Kaladin asked. Tell on us? I've never heard a parchment say more than a single word at a time. I doubt he could act as a spy.
I don't know, Teft grumbled. But I've never liked them. They seem to be able to talk to each other without making any sounds. I don't like the way they look.
Teft, Kaladin said flatly. If we rejected Bridgman based on their looks, we'd have kicked you out weeks ago for that face of yours.
Teft grunted. Then he smiled.
What? Kaladin asked.
Nothing, he said. Just, for a moment you reminded me of better days. Before this storm came crashing down on me. You realize the odds, don't you? Fighting our way free, escaping a man like Sadeus?
Kaladin nodded solemnly.
Good, Teft said. Well, since you aren't inclined to do it, I'll keep an eye on our friend Shen over there. You can thank me after I stop him from sticking a knife in your back. I don't think we have to worry.
You're young, Teft said. I'm old.
That makes you wiser, presumably?
Damnation no, Teft said. The only thing it proves is that I've more experience staying alive than you. I'll watch him. You just train the rest of this sorry lot to...
He trailed off, looking around.
To keep from tripping over their own feet the moment someone threatens them. You understand?
Kaladin nodded. That sounded much like something one of Kaladin's old sergeants would say. Teft was insistent on not talking about his past, but he never had seemed as beaten down as most of the others.
All right, Kaladin said. Make sure the men take care of their equipment.
What will you be doing?
Walking, Kaladin said. And thinking.
An hour later, Kaladin still wandered Sadeus's war camp. He'd need to return to the lumberyard soon. His men were on chasm duty again, and had been given only a few free hours to care for equipment. As a youth, he hadn't understood why his father had often gone walking to think. The older Kaladin grew, the more he found himself imitating his father's habits. Walking, moving, it did something to his mind. The constant passing of tents, colors cycling, men bustling, it created a sense of change, and it made his thoughts want to move as well.
Don't hedge bets with your life, Kaladin, Dirk had always said. Don't put in a chip when you have a pocket full of marks. Bet them all or leave the table.
Syl danced before him, jumping from shoulder to shoulder in the crowded street. Occasionally she'd land on the head of someone passing in the other direction, and sit there, legs crossed as she passed Kaladin. All his fears were on the table. He was determined to help the bridgeman. But something itched at him. A worry that he couldn't yet explain.
You seem troubled, Syl said, landing on his shoulder.
She wore a cap and jacket over her usual dress, as if imitating nearby shopkeepers. They passed the apothecary's shop. Kaladin barely bothered to glance at it. He had no knobweed sap to sell. He'd run out of supplies soon. He'd told his men that he'd train them to fight, but that would take time. And once they were trained, how would they get spears out of the chasms to use in the escape? Sneaking them out would be tough, considering how they were searched. They could just start fighting at the search itself, but that would only put the entire war camp on alert. Problems, problems. The more he thought, the more impossible his task seemed. He made way for a couple of soldiers in forest green coats. Their brown eyes marked them as common citizens, but the white knots on their shoulders meant they were citizen officers. Squad leaders and sergeants.
Kaladin? Syl asked.
Getting the bridgeman out is as large a task as I've ever faced. Much more difficult than my other escape attempts as a slave. And I failed at each of those. I can't help wondering if I'm setting myself up for another disaster.
It will be different this time, Kaladin, Syl said. I can feel it.
That sounds like something Tian would say. His death proves that words don't change anything, Syl. Before you ask, I'm not sinking into despair again. But I can't ignore what has happened to me. It started with Tian. Since that moment, it seems that every time I've specifically picked people to protect, they've ended up dead. Every time. It's enough to make me wonder if the Almighty himself hates me. She frowned.
I think you're being foolish. Besides, if anything, he'd hate the people who died, not you. You lived.
I suppose it's self-centered to make it all about me. But still, I survive every time when almost nobody else does. Over and over again. My old spearman squad, the first bridge crew I ran with, numerous slaves I've tried to help escape. There's a pattern. It's getting harder and harder to ignore.
Maybe the Almighty is preserving you, Syl said.
Kaladin hesitated on the street. A passing soldier cursed and shoved him aside. Something about this whole conversation was wrong. Kaladin moved over beside a rain barrel set between two sturdy stone-walled shops. Syl, he said, you mentioned the Almighty.
You did first.
Ignore that for now. Do you believe in the Almighty? Do you know if he really exists? Syl cocked her head.
I don't know. Huh. Well, there are a lot of things I don't know. But I should know this one, I think. Maybe?
She seemed very perplexed. I'm not sure if I believe, Kaladin said, looking out at the street. My mother did, and my father always spoke of the heralds with reverence. I think he believed too, but maybe just because of the traditions of healing that are said to have come from the heralds. The Ardens ignore us, bridgemen. They used to visit the soldiers when I was in Amaram's army, but I haven't seen a single one in the lumberyard. I haven't given it much thought. Believing never seemed to help any of the soldiers.
So if you don't believe, then there's no reason to think that the Almighty hates you.
Except, Kaladin said, if there is no Almighty, there might be something else. I don't know. A lot of the soldiers I knew were superstitious. They'd talk about things like the old magic and the Night Watcher, things that could bring a man bad luck. I scoffed at them. But how long can I continue to ignore that possibility? What if all of these failures can be traced to something like that? Syl looked disturbed. The cap and jacket she'd been wearing dissolved to mist, and she wrapped her arms around herself as if chilled by his comments. Odium reigns. Syl, he said, frowning, thinking back to his strange dream. Have you ever heard of something called odium? I don't mean the feeling, I mean a person or something called by that name. Syl suddenly hissed. It was a feral, disturbing sound. She zipped off his shoulder, becoming a darting streak of light, and shot up underneath the eaves of the next building. He blinked. Syl, he called, drawing the attention of a couple of passing washwomen.
The Spren did not reappear. Kaladin folded his arms. That word had set her off. Why? A loud series of curses interrupted his thoughts. Kaladin spun as a man burst out of a handsome stone building across the street and shoved a half-naked woman out in front of him. The man had bright blue eyes, and his coat, carried over one arm, had red knots on the shoulder. A light-eyed officer, not very high-ranking. Perhaps Seventh Don. The half-dressed woman fell to the ground. She held the loose front of the dress to her chest, crying, her long black hair down and tied with two red ribbons. The dress was that of a light-eyed woman, except that both sleeves were short, safe hand exposed. A courtesan. The officer continued to curse as he pulled on his coat. He didn't do up the buttons. Instead, he stepped forward and kicked the whore in the belly. She gasped, pain spren pulling from the ground and gathering around her. Nobody on the street paused, though most did hurry on their way, heads down. Kaladin growled, jumping into the roadway, pushing his way past a group of soldiers. Then he stopped. Three men in blue stepped out of the crowd, moving purposefully between the fallen woman and the officer in red. Only one was light-eyed, judging by the knots on his shoulders. Golden knots. A high-ranking man indeed. Second or third Don. These obviously weren't from Sadius's army, not with those well-pressed blue coats. Sadius's officer hesitated. The officer in blue rested his hand on the hilt of his sword. The other two were holding fine halberds with gleaming half-moon heads. A group of soldiers in red moved out of the crowd and began to surround those in blue. The air grew tense, and Kaladin realized that the street, bustling just moments ago, was quickly emptying. He stood practically alone, the only one watching the three men in blue, now surrounded by seven in red. The woman was still on the ground, sniffling. She huddled next to the blue-garbed officer. The man who had kicked her, a thick-browed brute with a mop of uncombed black hair, began to button up the right side of his coat.
"You don't belong here, friends. It seems you wandered into the wrong war camp."
"We have legitimate business," said the officer in blue. He had light golden hair, speckled with a lethy black, and a handsome face. He held his hand before him as if wishing to shake hands with Sadius's officer.
"Come now," he said affably. "Whatever your problem with this woman, I'm sure it can be resolved without anger or violence."
Kaladin moved back under the overhang where Syl had hidden.
"She's a whore," Sadius's man said.
"I can see that," replied the man in blue. He kept his hand out. The officer in red spat on it.
"I see," said the blonde man.
He pulled his hand back, and twisting lines of mist gathered in the air, coalescing in his hands as he raised them to an offensive posture. A massive sword appeared, as long as a man is tall. It dripped with water that condensed along its cold, glimmering length. It was beautiful, long and sinuous. Its single edge rippled like an eel and curved up to a point. The back bore delicate ridges, like crystal formations. Sadius's officer stumbled away and fell, his face pale. The soldiers in red scattered. The officer cursed at them, as vile a curse as Kaladin had ever heard, but none returned to help him. With a final glare, he scrambled up the steps back into the building. The door slammed, leaving the roadway eerily silent. Kaladin was the only one on the street besides the soldiers in blue and the fallen courtesan. The shardbearer gave Kaladin a glance, but obviously judged him no threat. He thrust his sword into the stones. The blade sank in easily and stood with its hilt toward the sky. The young shardbearer then gave his hand to the fallen whore.
"What did you do to him?" out of curiosity.
Hesitantly, she took his hand and let him pull her to her feet.
"He refused to pay, claiming his reputation made it a pleasure for me."
She grimaced.
"He kicked me the first time after I made a comment about his reputation. It apparently wasn't what he thought he was known for."
The Bright Lord chuckled.
I suggest you insist on being paid first from now on. We'll escort you to the border. I advise against returning to Sadius's war camp anytime soon. The woman nodded, holding the front of her dress to her chest. Her safe hand was still exposed. Sleek, with tan skin, the fingers long and delicate. Kaladin found himself staring at it and blushing. She sidled up to the bright lord while his two comrades watched the sides of the streets, halberds ready. Even with her hair disheveled and her makeup smudged, she was quite pretty.
Thank you, bright lord. Perhaps I could interest you? There would be no charge.
The young bright lord raised an eyebrow. Tempting, he said, but my father would kill me. He has this thing about the old ways.
A pity,
she said, pulling away from him, awkwardly covering her chest as she slipped her arm into its sleeve. She took out a glove for her safe hand.
Your father is quite prudish, then?
You might say that. He turned toward Kaladin. Oh, bridge boy.
Bridge boy?
This lordling looked to be just a few years older than Kaladin himself. Run and give word to Bright Lord Rerol Makarim, the shardbearer said, flipping something across the street toward Kaladin. A sphere. It sparkled in the sunlight before Kaladin caught it. He's in the 6th Battalion. Tell him that Adolin Colin won't make today's meeting. I'll send word to reschedule another time. Kaladin looked down at the sphere. An emerald chip. More than he normally earned in 2 weeks. He looked up. The young Bright Lord and his two men were already retreating, the whore following.
You rushed to help her,
a voice said. He looked up as Syl floated down to rest on his shoulder.
That was very noble of you.
Those others got there first, Kaladin said.
And one of them a Light Eyes, no less. What was in it for him? You still tried to help.
Foolishly, Kaladin said. What would I have done? Fought down a Light Eyes? That would have drawn half the camp's soldiers down on me, and the whore would just have been beaten more for causing such a fracas. She could have ended up dead for my efforts. He fell silent. That sounded too much like what he'd been saying before. He couldn't give in to assuming he was cursed, or had bad luck, or whatever it was. Superstition never got a man anywhere. But he had to admit the pattern was disturbing. If he acted as he always had before, how could he expect different results? He had to try something new. Change, somehow. This was going to take more thought. Kaladin began walking back toward the lumberyard.
Aren't you going to do what the Bright Lord asked?
Syl said. She didn't show any lingering effects of her sudden fright. It was as if she wanted to pretend it hadn't happened. After how he treated me, Kaladin snapped.
It wasn't that bad.
I'm not going to bow to them, Kaladin said. I'm done running at their whims just because they expect me to do so. If he was so worried about this message, then he should have waited to make certain I was willing.
You took his sphere.
Earned by the sweat of the dark eyes he exploits. Syl fell silent for a moment.
This darkness about you when you talk of them frightens me, Kaladin. You stop being yourself when you think about Light Eyes.
He didn't respond, just continuing on his way. He owed that Bright Lord nothing, and besides, he had orders to be back in the lumberyard. But the man had stepped up to protect the woman. No, Kaladin told himself forcefully. He was just looking for a way to embarrass one of Sadius's officers. Everyone knows there's tension between the camps. And that was all he let himself think on the subject.
Forty-seven. Storm Blessings. 1 year ago. Kaladin turned the rock over in his fingers, letting the facets of suspended quartz catch the light. He leaned against a large boulder, 1 foot pressed back against the stone, his spear next to him. The rock caught the light,
spinning it in different colors, depending on the direction he turned it. Beautiful miniature crystals shimmered, like the cities made of gemstones mentioned in lore. Around him, High Marshal Amaram's army prepared for battle. 6,000 men sharpened spears or strapped on leather armor. The battlefield was nearby, and with no high storms expected, the army had spent the night in tents. It had been nearly 4 years since he'd joined Amaram's army on that rainy night. 4 years. And an eternity. Soldiers hurried this way and that. Some raised hands and called greetings to Kaladin. He nodded to them, pocketing the stone, then folded his arms to wait. In the near distance, Amaram's standard was already flying, a burgundy field blazoned with a dark green glyph pair, shaped like a white spine with tusks upraised. Merim and Hoch. Honor and determination. The banner fluttered before a rising sun, the morning's chills starting to give way to the heat of the day. Kaladin turned, looking eastward, toward a home to which he could never return. He'd decided months ago. His enlistment would be up in a few weeks, but he would sign on again. He couldn't face his parents after having broken his promise to protect Tien. A heavy-set, dark-eyed soldier trotted up to him, an axe strapped to his back, white knots on his shoulders. The non-standard weapon was a privilege of being a squad leader. Gare had beefy forearms and a thick black beard, though he'd lost a large section of scalp on the right side of his head. He was followed by two of his sergeants, Nalum and Korabet.
"Kaladin," Gare said. "Stormfather, man, why are you pestering me? On a battle day?"
"I'm well aware of what's ahead, Gare," Kaladin said, arms still folded. Several companies were already gathering, forming ranks. Dalet would see Kaladin's own squad into place. At the front, they'd decided. Their enemy, a light eyes named Halaw, was fond of long volleys. They'd fought his men several times before. One time in particular was burned into Kaladin's memory and soul. He had joined Amaram's army expecting to defend the Alethi borders, and defend them he did, against other Alethi, lesser landlords who sought to slice off bits of High Prince Sadius's lands. Occasionally, Amaram's armies would try to seize territory from other High Princes, lands Amaram claimed really belonged to Sadius, and had been stolen years before. Kaladin didn't know what to make of that. Of all Light Eyes, Amaram was the only one he trusted. But it did seem like they were doing the same thing as the armies they fought.
"Kaladin?" Gare asked impatiently.
"You have something I want," Kaladin said. "New recruit, just joined yesterday. Galen says his name is Sen." Gare scowled.
"I'm supposed to play this game with you now? Talk to me after the battle. If the boy survives, maybe I'll give him to you."
He turned to leave, cronies following. Kaladin stood up straight, picking up his spear. The motion stopped Gare in his tracks.
"It's not going to be a trouble to you," Kaladin said quietly. "Just send the boy to my squad. Accept your payment. Stay quiet."
He pulled out a pouch of spheres.
"Maybe I don't want to sell him," Gare said, turning back.
"You're not selling him. You're transferring him to me." Gare eyed the pouch.
"Well, then maybe I don't like how everyone does what you tell them. I don't care how good you are with a spear. My squad is my own."
"I'm not going to give you any more, Gare," Kaladin said, dropping the pouch to the ground. The spheres clinked. "We both know the boy is useless to you. Untrained, ill-equipped, too small to make a good line soldier. Send him to me." Kaladin turned and began to walk away. Within seconds, he heard a clink as Gare recovered the pouch.
"Can't blame a man for trying."
Kaladin kept walking.
"What do these recruits mean to you anyway?" Gare called after Kaladin. "Your squad is half made up of men too small to fight properly. Almost makes a man think you want to get killed."
Kaladin ignored him. He passed through the camp, waving to those who waved at him. Most everyone kept out of his way, either because they knew and respected him, or they'd heard of his reputation. Youngest squad leader in the army, only 4 years of experience and already in command. A dark-eyed man had to travel to the shattered plains to go any higher in rank. The camp was a bedlam of soldiers hurrying about in last-minute preparations. More and more companies were gathering at the line, and Kaladin could see the enemy lining up on the shallow ridge across the field to the west. The enemy. That was what they were called. Yet whenever there was an actual border dispute with the Badens or the Reshi, those men would line up beside Amaram's troops and they would fight together. It was as if the Night Watcher toyed with them, playing some forbidden game of chance, occasionally setting the men on his game board as allies, then setting them to kill one another the next day. That wasn't for spearmen to think about. So he'd been told. Repeatedly. He supposed he should listen, as he figured that his duty was to keep his squad alive as best he could. Winning was secondary to that. You can't kill to protect. He found the surgeon's station easily. He could smell the scents of antiseptics and of small fires burning. Those smells reminded him of his youth, which now seemed so far, far away. Had he ever really planned to go become a surgeon? What had happened to his parents? What of Roshon? Meaningless now. He'd sent word to them via Amaram's scribes, a terse note that had cost him a week's wages. They knew he'd failed, and they knew he didn't intend to return. There had been no reply. Ben was the chief of the surgeons, a tall man with a bulbous nose and a long face. He stood watching as his apprentices folded bandages. Kaladin had once idly considered getting wounded so he could join them. All of the apprentices had some incapacitation that prevented them from fighting.